the market's dive on disappointing job numbers.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith in for Bill Radke. Welcome to the Morning Open, when we take a look at business and the economy as Wall Street starts its trading day. U.S. companies hired far fewer people in May than expected. We'll talk about why in just a moment. But first, let's do the numbers. It is ugly out there. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 196 points, 1.9% to 10,058. The NASDAQ down 1.75%, 40 points to 2,262. The S&P 500 down 1.9%, 21 points to 1,081. The U.S. economy added 430,000 jobs in May. And that sounds like good news, but 410,000 of those were temporary census jobs. Chris Lowe is chief economist with FTN Financial. He joins us live now from New York, as he does most Fridays. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning.
So, Chris, not counting the census, the economy added about 20,000 jobs in May. That is way down from April, when the private sector added 230,000 jobs. What's going on here?
Well, that's right. And unfortunately, the average duration of those census jobs is 2 weeks. So you really do have to focus on private sector jobs. It was a broad-based slowdown. We had a slowdown in manufacturing hiring, a big drop in construction hiring. And then on the service side, the smallest job growth since December, mostly because of a drop in retail and financial hiring.
Is job growth permanently slowing down?
I don't think so. There were some positive signs in this report. What it suggests to me is that employers are nervous. They're nervous about what's happening in Europe. They're nervous about an engineered slowdown in China, and they're trying to make do with fewer people. But there was a fairly significant increase in the work week. Aggregate hours worked also increased.
And that's good news?
Well, I tell you why it's good news, because it shows they are increasing output and they're trying to make do with fewer people. Right now, that translates to productivity growth. But we know that productivity gains are more difficult to achieve right now because, frankly, we've chalked up so many. And they can only do without hiring for a brief period of time if they're going to keep output this high.
So demand is up, and we're working harder to meet that demand. But we did earlier this week see retail sales were disappointing. Is it possible that demand is going to start slowing down for companies and productivity will drop and we won't hire?
Well, even there was some positive news in May. The most important thing is that average hourly earnings were up, and again, by more than expected, so that there should be enough income growth to keep consumption going forward. Also in May, we had an unexpected increase in car sales, and retailers, even though they said they were disappointed by May results, did say that things were perking up toward the end of the month, and they're hopeful for June. So at least there's some reason for optimism.
Our optimist, Chris Lowe with FTN Financial. Thank you, Chris.
You're welcome.
One major concern about the job market is the rising number of long-term unemployed and how to deal with long-term unemployment benefits. Our own Elisa Roth joins us live now from our New York Bureau. Good morning, Elisa.
Good morning.
Elisa, Congress has been looking at extending unemployment benefits for a while now. What are some of the issues involved?
Well, the discussion really centers on whether unemployment benefits help people or are ultimately a hindrance. Now, some people, generally on the left, say those who don't have jobs need unemployment benefits until they can find work, because as we've seen today, there just aren't very many jobs out there. In the other camp are people, generally more on the right, who say unemployment benefits are a disincentive to looking for work. That is, if you can get paid to essentially do nothing, then why would you even try to find a job?
How do you think today's numbers will affect the debate?
Well, I talked to Heather Boucher this morning. She's an economist at the Center for American Progress, which is a left-leaning think tank. And she says the numbers that came out should really be a call for policymakers to extend those benefits once and for all.
And employers simply aren't hiring. We are not seeing the kind of private sector employment gains that we need to see to get this economy moving. And those extended benefits not only help workers and their families, but they will help to support local economies by putting dollars into them.
But it also depends in part whether you think today's numbers were bad or not. You know, as we've been hearing, some economists say they weren't that bad because at least we're not losing jobs. So that might be an argument for not extending the benefits again.
Elisa Roth in New York. Thank you, Elisa.
You're welcome.
for listening to The Morning Report for Friday, June 4th at marketplace.org. The American Society of Clinical Oncology starts its big annual conference today in Chicago. A new study into breast cancer finds a link between the way private oncologists get paid and how they prescribe chemotherapy. From our health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Gregory Warner reports.
Oncologists in private practice rely on the reimbursements they get from insurance companies for administering chemotherapy. That money pays for things that aren't covered by insurance so well. Things like counseling and nutrition advice and all the work that nurses do. A new study finds that that financial incentive to push patients to chemotherapy can make doctors reluctant to offer a test that may tell breast cancer patients they don't need chemo.
It's hard to do the test that says, gee, don't give the patient chemotherapy, and it's money out of his pocket.
Julian Schenk wrote the study. He's a gynecological oncologist at Northwestern Memorial Hospital in Chicago. The test, called a gene expression test, can analyze the tumor tissue and predict the chance of that cancer recurring. If the risk is low, the woman may not need chemo. Christine Weldon directs the Center for Business Models in Healthcare. She co-authored the study. She says that insurance companies need to start paying doctors for all the work they do, not just chemotherapy.
Pay them for the time to have the discussion about the test, not have the drug reimbursement be driving the sustainability of their practice.
Some doctors she interviewed for the study said they don't tell their patients about the test, not unless the patient brings it up first. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
The group of 20 nations has gathered in South Korea today to talk global economic recovery. One major point of controversy is whether banks should be taxed to pay for future bailouts. U.S. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner is there. He says he's going to fight that tax. The financial meltdown has had a lot of investors playing it safe, flocking to investments like U.S. Treasury bonds. But the economy has been improving, and now investors are ready to take on more risk, as John Dimsdale reports.
As a safe investment, Treasury bonds have been in high demand during the recession.
We've had one hell of a rally in the bond market.
Marilyn Cohen is president of Envision Capital Management. She says the flight to safety allowed the Treasury Department to sell government debt cheap. But now that the economy shows signs of recovery, buyers of those notes are turning to riskier investments with potentially higher returns, and yields on those Treasury notes have started to climb.
There will become a time when the institutional investor, who is really, you know, the 800-pound gorilla, will say, you know what, I really have no interest in a 10-year treasury. I'm going into the equity market, or I'm going into, you know, commodities and or other things.
Cohen says that would force Treasury to offer more enticing returns on government debt to investors. Presumably, though, a stronger economy would also generate more government revenue, and therefore less debt, assuming politicians can control spending. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Japan has a new prime minister today. A day after the previous leader quit, Japan's parliament chose Finance Minister Naoto Kan. He inherits an economy that's been lost for the better part of two decades. Is he the man to turn it around? Our Asia correspondent Scott Tong reports.
Financial markets cheered Naoto Kan's election. Japanese bonds rose, hoping Kan can do what his predecessor couldn't, pay down Japanese debt. By some measures, it's the largest in the world. Kan is known for a strong personality. He promotes fiscal discipline and currency policies to help companies like Sony and Toyota compete against the Americans. But not so fast, says Robert Dujarric at Temple University's Tokyo campus. He says the office of prime minister has limited power.
The prime minister of Japan is not the president of the United States. He's not even the prime minister of the United Kingdom. The personality of prime minister has less of an impact on policy.
He says the economic agenda is clear. Japan's debt and its aging society.
The number of Japanese of working age is going down very rapidly. The number of elderly is rising, and every year there are fewer and fewer births in the country.
How Japan fares is being watched closely. Most of the developed world is aging and peering over the same demographic cliff. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
BP reports this hour the cap it put over the leak in the Gulf of Mexico is catching some oil. Meanwhile, there's a six-month stop on deepwater drilling in the Gulf, and oil drillers in the Gulf's shallow waters will have to stop temporarily, but only temporarily. Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
Most of the 3,500 rigs in the Gulf are pumping in 1,000 feet of water or less. Fewer than 50 are in deep water. John Rend drills in shallow water, sometimes just a couple hundred feet deep. He says it's a whole different world from BP's deep water operations. For one thing, his blowout preventers, designed to keep a well from exploding, sit on top of the water.
We walk down a flight of stairs and go to them, literally.
The crippled BP blowout preventer is down so deep it can only be reached by robots, ditto for the blown-out wellhead. Divers can usually reach shallow wells, but some environmentalists say shallow wells are just as dangerous as deep ones, especially for wildlife. Kieran Suckling is executive director of the Center for Biological Diversity.
Wildlife can be even more affected by blowouts in shallow water because shallow water drilling tends to be much closer. Sure.
And Suckling says blowouts are more common in less than 500 feet of water. He points out that the biggest spill ever in the Gulf occurred at about 160 feet. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Gentlemen, start your razors. After months of hype, Gillette's latest razor will hit store shelves this weekend, but it faces some stiff competition. From St. Louis Public Radio, Matt Sepik reports.
This latest version of Gillette's Fusion, the ProGlide, still has just 6 blades, but you wouldn't know it from the hundreds of millions of dollars Gillette pumped into the razor's design and its marketing.
I am ready to take the ProGlide challenge!
The ProGlide features thinner blades and better lubrication, but Damon Jones with Gillette parent Procter & Gamble says even the loudest ads aren't enough to make men switch brands.
It's one thing to watch a commercial, but when we put the razor in the hands of guys and they try it, they tell us, wow. So we are really going to depend a lot on the word of mouth.
Meanwhile, Schick, owned by Energizer, is pushing its new Hydro Razor just as aggressively. Its selling point is a reservoir of water-activated gel. Lyndall Chu is a marketing professor at the University of Missouri-St. Louis. He says Schick has always been more innovative, even adding tiny clippers to its earlier Quattro line.
This product has a 4-blade disposable on one end. It has a hair-cutting tool on the other end. It's operated by a AAA battery.
But despite Schick's technical wizardry, Chu says it'll have to fight hard for shelf space because Gillette's Procter & Gamble dominates the consumer products industry.
They're going very aggressive with these billion-dollar brands that they have and carving out deals that often will wipe out the number 2 brand, not just the number 3, 4, 5, and 6 brand.
Chu says Procter & Gamble's Duracell is a perfect example. Earlier this year, it used its market clout to bump Energizer batteries out of CVS drugstores. But for customers confused by all the competing razor blades, vintage simplicity is making a comeback. Online retailers of those double-edged safety blades your grandfather used say business is booming. And while replacement cartridges for the latest razors can cost more than $4 each, the retro blades are as little as 15 cents. In St. Louis, I'm Matt Sepik for Marketplace.
And finally, call it the Iceland edition. European airline EasyJet said today it's fitting its planes with a radar to detect volcanic ash. It's called the Airborne Volcanic Object Identifier and Detector, or AVOID. It should be able to spot ash clouds up to 60 miles away. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith, and this is the Marketplace Morning Report.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.